Hello and welcome. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for episode one of the CMEO cast, Deciphering Narcolepsy, Analyzing Signs and Symptoms for Early Diagnosis. The podcast series is supported by an educational grant from Avadel CNS Pharmaceuticals. I'm Dr. Anne-Marie Morse. I am the Director of Child Neurology and Pediatric Sleep Medicine at Geisinger Jenneweis Children's Hospital and extraordinarily passionate about education around narcolepsy. And I am so privileged to be here today with Dr. Lindsay McCullough. Lindsay, please provide an introduction.
Hi, I'm Lindsay McCullough. I'm really excited to be here and thank you to Dr. Morse and CME Outfitters for having me. I am an internist and sleep physician at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. I am also very passionate about medical education and education to the general public about sleep health and sleep disorders. As someone who also lives with narcolepsy myself, I am very interested and passionate about this topic, particularly improving the diagnostic delay in narcolepsy.
Well, I think that we have our listeners in for a very special treat because not only being able to get the experience of taking care of individuals with narcolepsy, but the unique experience as a person with narcolepsy and really helping us to understand what that journey looks like. Our goal for this podcast today is to discuss primary symptoms under-recognized clinical presentations in real-world practical tips for differential diagnosis of narcolepsy type 1 and type 2. Let's get into this. So Lindsay, we always talk about what the pentad symptoms or the five core symptoms of narcolepsy are. And I think that everyone can say, oh, excessive daytime sleepiness, of course, sleepy is a symptom that I need to look at. I think that sometimes we need to think about what does the face of sleepiness look like. It is the most sensitive symptom of narcolepsy. 100% of patients of narcolepsy have excessive daytime sleepiness. But help me unpack a little bit what the other symptoms may look like. Like, what do we call them and what may they look like in clinical practice that may help people to be able to better recognize narcolepsy? Because surprisingly, not all patients who have narcolepsy are coming to the clinic with the complaint, the primary complaint of excessive daytime sleepiness. Sometimes it is looking at some of these other symptoms, which we'll look at in a little bit more detail later on.
Yes, Anne, I completely agree. Patients will come in complaining of sleepiness, but I think even to the degree that they're recognizing sleepiness in themselves versus, you know, is it their normal? I think that can even be variable in how they're reporting that. I find in my clinic that when asking patients about sleep-related hallucinations, so these are hallucinations that people may have as they're falling asleep or waking up. They may be visual. They may see a figure over their bed or maybe in the corner, or they may just see some, you know, dark circles. They may feel something touching them, or they may hear things that aren't there. And when I ask them, people are often surprised because this has happened to them, but they were either afraid to tell somebody or didn't realize that it was abnormal. So that's something that you may see. And this can happen also in patients with narcolepsy when they're napping as well as when they're sleeping at night. Sleep paralysis is another symptom that can be seen in narcolepsy, can also be seen in other sleep disorders as well. But that experience that you have where you wake up or you're falling asleep, typically when you're waking up out of sleep and you can't speak or move. And it generally lasts just a few seconds, sometimes a couple minutes, but it's really hard for patients to characterize how long it lasts. Generally, it's very frightening to patients. So sometimes that's the presenting complaint in clinic is the sleep paralysis. Cataplexy is something I had a patient come in that was a nurse the other day who was more familiar with some of the symptoms and had some more health literacy, but really asking about cataplexy, which is the loss of muscle tone, it can be very subtle with emotions. So generally, if something is making them laugh or funny, a surprise, people may have trouble telling a joke, for example, because their jaw is weak. They may notice their knees buckle or they drop things if they're laughing. And I find that if people have read about narcolepsy, they may come in and say, oh yeah, I just like pass out automatically. So the important thing about cataplexy is that people have retained alertness. So they are awake when this is happening, but they can lose all muscle control, whether it is very subtle with just their jaw or from the head down falling to the ground. So it can be subtle or dramatic. And I think the last symptom that can be confusing for patients and general practitioners, sleep providers, is the disrupted nighttime sleep, which was added as one of the five cardinal symptoms more recently than the other four. Patients with narcolepsy, they'll often come in and say, I can't stay awake during the day, but I also can't sleep at night. I'm waking up frequently at night. And if you're not taking a full clinical history or you're not aware of the symptom, it can sound like insomnia, somebody's just having trouble sleeping at night, and you might send them for a different treatment or giving them a sleeping medicine, which could potentially make things worse. So just in my practice, there can be some nuances, I think, and different symptoms than just the classic, I'm really sleepy and I'm falling asleep at work or at class.
Yeah, and I think that you're 100% correct. Disturbed nocturnal sleep is definitely an underrecognized symptom, but I think it really does illustrate the innate pathophysiology, especially within narcolepsy type 1, which we have a better understanding of, which is that the entire disease process and even these 10 TED symptoms are being characterized by a REM dissociative phenomena and also sleep state instability. And so we've seen that DNS is so substantial that even when we apply machine learning models and artificial intelligence to the polysomnography, and Emmanuel Mignot and his group had done this, it had demonstrated that the recognition of narcolepsy type 1 just based on a polysomnography due to the sleep state instability is superior to the MSLT. And so again, demonstrating this characterization and demonstrating what we see clinically when we're reading polysomnographies of going, is this REM sleep? Because I feel like there's some N2 feature in there. And the reality is it's probably because there is. They have this very, very innate sleep state instability. And so one of the take-home points I very frequently will tell people is that if you're calling someone insomnia and they're excessively sleepy, they're falling asleep inappropriately, you have the wrong diagnosis. Insomnia is typically a hyperactivated state. And so when you're seeing someone who's saying, I can't stay asleep, please make sure that you have narcolepsy on your differential. The other thing that I always say in terms of a call to action of recognition is that many times when cataplexy is the presenting symptom, and we're talking about the pediatric age group, which is we're going to see in some of the upcoming slides or upcoming conversation, that can be a presenting symptom. That active motor phenomena can also be a part of the cataplexy spectrum. And so in kids and those with an abrupt onset, you can see eyebrow raising, tongue thrusting, even dyskinetic movements with a persistent hypotonia. And so recognizing that some of these things may not be the classic coming right out of the textbook, but being able to package it all together and think through it. So when we're looking at this, there are a wide variety of symptoms. And many times we relegate ourselves to these pentad symptoms, and we'll even have further conversation at how poor we are at even recognizing that. There's been surveys that have looked at primary care and sleep professionals being able to recognize and characterize the pentad symptoms. But being able to look at what are all the ways that an individual narcolepsy may manifest, it may help us to not only identify them in our sleep clinic, but also beyond our sleep clinic. So there have been some really good characterization of this. Lindsay, help me understand some of the information and what we're seeing in regards to what kind of symptoms might be present at baseline, and what are the things that should start creating that like five alarm fire in people's heads?
So this is really interesting. This came out of a group from Amsterdam where there's a narcolepsy monitor app that they have developed. And they sent out this app to patients. They promoted it at meetings for physicians to provide to their patients. There's been a lot of publicity around this app. And people who have sleepiness or think they might have narcolepsy but don't have a diagnosis yet, or they do have a diagnosis of narcolepsy, can download this app and pick from a variety of symptoms or type in some symptoms that they may have with narcolepsy. And they update it weekly. And we're able to gather data on symptoms that are not within that pentad that people are experiencing. And it's so interesting to see that excessive daytime sleepiness is number one, but we don't get to any of the pentad symptoms again until towards the end of the list of symptoms. There's lack of energy, there's trouble concentrating, trouble with memory, and a lot of patients with narcolepsy who come to see me, it's more about how they're functioning during the day and are they able to work? Are they able to function at work? You know, there's this economic and social as well impact that narcolepsy has and has a big impact. So I think it's really interesting to get this direct data from the patients who are updating this to learn how it's really impacting their lives and how, when we say daytime sleepiness, what does that actually mean? Are you having difficulty concentrating, or, you know, these automatic behaviors, which can include someone's driving and get 10 minutes down the line, doesn't know where they are. Other things that fly under the radar sometimes that we don't ask about. Another thing that I think is interesting that comes out of these data is the amount of anxiety, sadness, depression, binge eating even that has been identified in narcolepsy that we don't talk about a lot. We know that there is a correlation with depression and other mood disorders, but you really see the impact of this in real time with real patients.
Yeah. And I think that really some of the things that I would pull out in terms of the language that is used and how these are being characterized is whether or not are these different symptoms versus differences in lexicon or differences in the words that people use to characterize the symptoms they're experiencing. We see right now, for instance, brain fog is a hot topic across central disorders of hypersomnolence. And it's a heated debate as to is that presentation of excessive daytime sleepiness? Is it distinct from daytime sleepiness? Is it some sort of combination? The other part that I'm actually surprised by is that some of the lower things that are ranked in this are problems at school or problems at work. This is actually quite different from when we looked at the Nexus Registry data, where excessive daytime sleepiness was the number one reason for seeking out care. And the second and third were deterioration in school and work performance. And so I think, again, it may be reflective of where you are in the globe as to what is being prioritized and how people are characterizing, but really illustrating that there are a lot of different ways that patients may be communicating to you the difficulties or the overall burden that they're experiencing. The final piece that I do think is really important and frequently overlooked, and Tom Scammell and Karen Maskey independently had done some really great work up at Harvard looking at this, is really some of that social impact. And specifically, Tom's group had looked at the impact on sex and libido, and the fact that 92% of the time, physicians aren't asking about that. So both the condition by itself, as well as the medications we use, can have a deleterious consequence. That's a huge quality of life factor, and everyone's embarrassed to have that conversation. So when are we first seeing the appearance of these symptoms, of these leading symptoms of narcolepsy, when we're examining some specific cohorts? So there was a beautiful study looking at this within Germany and breaking down sleep attacks, cataplexy, and excessive daytime sleepiness. And Lizzie, what is it that we were seeing when we're looking at the ages and kind of the distribution of what's leading people to come to the doctors and the symptom that is the most problematic for them?
So this was a really fantastic study that showed that most of the time around age 15 or so in the middle of adolescence, patients will come in complaining of excessive daytime sleepiness, and maybe they've identified it, maybe a parent or someone else has identified it, so around age 15. And then we see another bump in patients reporting actually mostly cataplexy, although there is sleep attacks and daytime sleepiness as well around age 35.
So we're seeing, again, something that in France, Yves Dauvier had published on this bimodal distribution of that we're seeing this increased peak in that kind of 15 years of age, 15, 16, and a secondary peak around 35. And what I find fascinating, though, is that there seems to be a discrepancy of, like, the excessive daytime sleepiness is much more the predominant leading feature when we're younger, where it almost seems like in the older age group, they kind of are like, we're used to being tired. Everyone's tired. It's these other things that become more problematic. Now, the other piece that I think is really important is that adolescence is this critical period, and especially within the United States, we know that 58 to 73% of middle school and high school students are insufficient sleepers. And so everyone is sleepy, and very commonly, especially since I see a lot of pediatrics, there's the report of sleepiness is normal. And so just that reminder that sleepiness is never normal, it's common. And in fact, I even had a conversation with one of my sleep fellows earlier today, and she was like, this patient only falls asleep when they're bored. And I said, well, boredom, does that make you go to sleep? And she goes, well, I kind of feel sleepy when I'm bored. And I said, that's never normal. So it is, again, a reminder that we will normalize abnormal things because they're common. And none of us like to be different. And because there is a stigma around not being able to do if we're sleepy. And so many of us also wear it as that badge of honor. And in medicine, we're the most guilty of it.
And Anne, it makes me wonder too, when you're talking about this age group and normalizing sleepiness, especially in the adolescents and the school start times. I know that we're starting to change that across the country, delaying the school start times, but the way schools are structured for adolescents, it's almost impossible for them to get sufficient sleep. So it's really hard to determine that sleepiness, is it pathological or not?
I 100% agree. And so when we're looking at narcolepsy in pediatric patients, and so whether you're listening to this and you're going, I'm an adult provider, I never see kids, this isn't relevant to me, I'm going to tell you what, it is extraordinarily relevant, because the child who has narcolepsy is going to be the adult who has narcolepsy. And most commonly, because of the delays in diagnosis and the lack of awareness, they're going to be coming to you undiagnosed. And so understanding what narcolepsy looks like in childhood is only going to benefit you, even if you only see adult patients, because you'll know the questions to ask, because they never come in without other medical comorbidity or other medications that's going to skew the picture. So being able to fully understand what are some of the other things that may appear in childhood and adolescence for narcolepsy is critically important. Lindsay, what is it that you typically are identifying or have read or seen in regards to pediatric patients?
I think you, first of all, bring up a great point about the relevance of the pediatric symptoms in adult providers. I'd say the vast majority of my patients who come in and I'm suspecting narcolepsy, I ask them about their symptoms. They tell me that a lot of their symptoms started when they were younger, in childhood or in adolescence. So I think picking up on these things and knowing what to ask is important. In kids, there's oftentimes more of a mood disturbance. So they may have depression or anxiety or some atypical symptoms that you wouldn't necessarily pick up on, where they're hyperactive. We think about kids with ADHD and how conversely they are way more active. They have behavioral problems. You mentioned the difference in cataplexy in kids, where they may be a little bit more dramatic with their mouth opening, their tongue falling out, maybe their head drooping, maybe some dyskinesias. Kids also just may suddenly start sleeping longer or may have the return of naps. They may have grown out of their naps, but now they need to nap again in the afternoon. Or you may see some start of parasomnias. So are they having abnormal behaviors at night, any sleep terrors, return of sleepwalking? That's suggesting that sleep state instability that's developed. In kids especially too, a rapid weight gain that starts suddenly is correlated tightly with narcolepsy. So if they're sleepy and they're all of a sudden gaining a bunch of weight and eating a lot of food, that can be attributed, as well as a precocious puberty we see tied in with narcolepsy.
Yeah. And I think, again, when we're talking about specifically narcolepsy type 1, we know that this is an orexin deficiency, and we know that we're impacting that neuroendocrine axis. And so it's not uncommon that I can look at a growth chart because of the institute I'm at, our EHR is 30 years young. And so we have very, very robust data to be able to look at. And I can say to the parent, did the symptoms start in 2015? And they almost look at me like I had a crystal ball. I'm like, no, I'm just looking at the growth chart. They were 25th percentile and they went up to 75th percentile. And now they're greater than 99th percentile. And they're like, yes, that's exactly when it started. And it's important to know these facts, because when it's a person comes in and they're an adult person and they do have a diagnosis of severe obstructive sleep apnea because of the morbid obesity they developed, and also because they have a REM dissociative condition or constantly entering into REM sleep, it is important to go beyond that and to make sure you're looking at all these other features. The other thing that I very frequently tell people is that if you identify REM behavior disorder in a pediatric age population, it is narcolepsy until proven otherwise, unless they're acutely withdrawing from psychiatric medications. And so it is important to kind of have this full depiction of what pediatric patients may experience, because that may be the insights you need to be able to appropriately diagnose The other final piece that I would just like to kind of call out is that when we talk about narcolepsy, most typically it is a hypersomnolence disorder, but not typically a hypersomnia disorder. So when adults have been studied with narcolepsy, they most typically are sleeping between 6 to 8 hours. And so sometimes, again, it runs into this concern of insufficient sleepers. At the acute onset for pediatrics, there is sometimes that prolongation of sleep. And so you do see this temporary period of hypersomnia. And so there, that can, again, be your calling card of this is the characteristics that the individual may be having. So we have just unpacked all these symptoms. It's like a very clear pentad symptoms. They almost seem like this should be the most obvious thing that ever walks into the room of being able to call this out. We've also characterized that this isn't something that is free of other medical comorbidity. And so therefore, they have to be seeing lots of other medical doctors who should also be able to recognize this. What are some of the risk factors for a diagnostic delay? What are some of the things that are putting us at risk? Even though we quote 8 to 10 years, we recognize most recent literature saying it's really 12 to 19 with just female gender being something that can prolong the diagnostic delay.
Yeah, it's really interesting thinking about, we know this, why aren't we identifying it sooner? And one of the biggest things that we found is that pediatric onset of symptoms or less than 18 years of age contributes to more of the diagnostic delay. In addition to that, the younger age of onset of cataplexy, the younger you are you identifying what this is? Is anybody seeing it as normal? If it's been part of your life that you've lived this whole time, that your parents have observed, everyone's observed. If there is a longer interval between the onset of sleepiness and cataplexy, they seem unrelated. So it's easy to attribute the sleepiness to insufficient sleep or maybe depression or something else and put those two things together. Also, we think about cataplexy itself as a pathognomonic sign almost for narcolepsy. It can occur in other conditions rarely, but really characteristic of narcolepsy type 1. But if you have someone with narcolepsy type 2, or someone that doesn't have cataplexy as frequently or less severe, that could lead to a diagnostic delay because they don't identify it themselves, know to bring it up to their doctor, or their doctor may not understand that it's cataplexy.
Yeah, and I think even when eliciting the history of cataplexy, something that we're learning is that when a person is more sleepy, so when they're on the verge of those sleep attacks, and they do have the propensity for having cataplexy, that it increases the likelihood of experiencing. And so what do we do naturally? We make associations and correlations. So when it gets packaged together as my sleepiness makes me clumsy, it makes me drop my iPhone and break the screen, it makes me trip over my own feet, it makes my head drop. We don't think of it as being distinct from sleepiness. And many times we don't identify it until we actually start treating the sleepiness. And a person goes, you know, that thing with my neck or my, I'm still clumsy and I'm not sleepy, I'm not falling asleep. And so that very frequent can be the challenge. And you're correct, cataplexy is the most specific symptom of narcolepsy. We've already said that excessive daytime sleepiness is the most sensitive, 100% of people. About 70% of individuals with narcolepsy will have cataplexy. However, in that 70%, only about 15 to 20% are going to be generalized cataplexies that walk in and go, I fall to the ground, I retain consciousness. And you're going, oh, you have narcolepsy with cataplexy. More frequently, you're going to have to really dig at pulling that history of, do you find that you have head drops, you get slurred speech, your mouth falls open, that you're dropping things from your hands, your knees are throttling. And please don't be fooled at thinking that you can just ask the question, when you laugh really hard, does this happen? Because in pediatrics, it can be completely without emotional content. And some individuals start to modify their emotional experiences so that they experience this less, or that they also have other emotional symptoms that can lead into having a symptom of cataplexy, such as fear, excitement, anger, and otherwise.
And I would say, too, when asking about cataplexy, it's normal for people who are laughing really, really hard to kind of curl over a little bit. So sometimes when you ask about it and people think about it really hard, they might answer yes. So it's good to ask about the subtle symptoms, but also thinking about cataplexy, someone, if you're laughing really hard, just think about your own experience. There's some variation in that where it's not abnormal.
Yeah, and this really comes down to what should you be doing to diagnose narcolepsy, and are you using appropriate strategies? And so first and foremost, clinical history, clinical history, clinical history. And before I ask you to kind of go into some of the other pieces, I very frequently advocate for us to remember that in medicine, we are taught that the clinical history diagnoses diseases. We use tests to support the diagnosis we've already made based on the history. And so the clinical history really is pivotal to being able to identify what is it that we think we're dealing with. And so beyond the clinical history, what else do you typically use or find that can be helpful for diagnosing and evaluating individuals who have narcolepsy?
So if I have a patient in front of me who I think potentially has narcolepsy, I'd want to pursue with some additional testing. So that would include an overnight sleep study and then a daytime multiple sleep latency test, which is where they have the opportunity the next day to take multiple naps for short periods of time. Leading up to that, though, it's really important that you make sure, number one, that they're not a shift worker because that can mess up with the testing, as well as that they're getting sufficient sleep. So getting sleep diaries, it's recommended 2 weeks before. In my clinical practice, usually I'll get 1 week before. And actigraphy, if available, to confirm the estimated sleep time in their sleep diaries. And the other thing that I think it's important to remember is thinking about the medications that they're on for possible comorbid disorders, especially psychiatric disorders. So we know that the SSRIs and SNRIs are among a group that can suppress REM sleep. There's several medications that can suppress REM sleep. So if it's safe and possible for them to be tapered off of the medication and be off the medication for a couple weeks before the study, you're more likely to have more accurate results. And the PSG or overnight sleep study and MSLT are shown to be fairly reliable in narcolepsy type 1 and narcolepsy type 2 less so. So sometimes you have to, if you have a very high index of suspicion, repeat the sleep study 6 months down the line.
Yeah. And so again, this is where I go back to history, diagnosis, test support. And so a couple of things that if you're a payer listening to this podcast, one of the things you're going to hear from me is do not delay or obstruct the care that I'm trying to provide my patients by asking me to do a home sleep test. They're completely inappropriate for an individual who I'm evaluating for narcolepsy. The second is that if I have an adult who is taking an overnight sleep test and I don't identify other pathology and I have an MSLT that shows 5 naps, that the patient falls asleep on all 5 and they have an average sleep latency of 9 minutes and 2 snore REMs, they have narcolepsy. And so with that stated, we recognize that individuals who have narcolepsy type 1, the MSLT was specifically designed for that. And so we typically are quoting statistics around 95% for sensitivity and specificity. However, that's in a clean medical history without any other medical comorbidities or any other medicines. And when we're looking at narcolepsy type 2, we're generally saying it's about 65%. So that means we're missing the mark on a variety of people. And it doesn't mean that those tests are not abnormal. It just means they are not meeting the diagnostic criteria. And really the call to action for our field is for us to do better. So what is the differential diagnosis for when you're seeing an individual where narcolepsy may be on the docket? It may be one of the things that we're thinking about. What are some of the other conditions that may be considered?
So when anyone comes in, if, let's say they're presenting with daytime sleepiness, you want to make sure that they're getting sufficient sleep, so are they sleep deprived, maybe out of necessity for work or home demands. Obstructive sleep apnea, very, very common condition, oftentimes can be comorbid with narcolepsy. But you want to make sure if they have that to rule it out, make sure that it's treated and optimized. If they have some risk factors for snoring, for example, make sure that you're asking about that. Depression or substance use can also mimic narcolepsy with sleepiness and fatigue. And there's other hypersomnia disorders that we're not discussing as much on this podcast, like idiopathic hypersomnia or Klein-Levin syndrome. There's just so many things that can present with sleepiness. So it's important, again, we keep reiterating this, to get a strong and a good clinical history. Are their sleep times really early or delayed, or do they have a circadian rhythm abnormality, or are they kicking a lot at night with periodic limb movement disorder? All sorts of things. Cataplexy, we've spoken about a lot. I think if someone is passing out or they're psychogenic cataplexy, that could be in the differential, but cataplexy is a little bit harder. I think there's not as much in the differential. There's some other disorders where it can show up, like Niemann-Pick disease and Prader-Willi, but not as much in the picture. If someone's reporting hallucinations, if they're surrounding sleep, we can see that with narcolepsy and occasionally with sleep apnea. But if it's more during the day, then thinking about things like schizophrenia or other psychiatric disorders, if somebody's having panic attacks during the day, I guess that can cause some things. But thinking about the hallucinations at night can really help you hone in on the sleep component.
And I love the fact that you brought up Niemann-Pick and Prader-Willi, because Niemann-Pick can have isolated cataplexy. There's been some case reports of it being narcolepsy with cataplexy. Prader-Willi, however, is a unique condition where they are uniquely susceptible to narcolepsy with cataplexy because it's a genetic disorder of hypothalamic dysfunction. And so what's fascinating about when you're evaluating that particular condition, they also have this hyperphagia and obesity. And so those conditions are examples of secondary narcolepsies. And it is important that we have a heightened suspicion for individuals who have other brain disorders that may be lesional in the areas of our hypothalamus to consider narcolepsy. So whether it's neuromyelitis optica, a traumatic brain injury, a craniopharyngioma, Prader-Willi syndrome, multiple sclerosis, these are things that you definitely want to keep on your radar. So there are clear criteria. The ICSD-3, the most recent revisions with the text revision, are providing this criteria for narcolepsy type 1 and type 2. In the prior versions, excessive daytime sleepiness in narcolepsy type 1 had to be present for at least 3 months. In the most recent revision, that no longer is a criteria. There is no chronologic period. In narcolepsy type 2, there still is. There also has been some other additions, like a SORAMP on the polysomnography can also lead to diagnosis, but help me kind of walk through what we know for the ICSD-3 text revision criteria for narcolepsy type 1 and type 2.
So the ICSD-3 text revision added a couple things to enhance our diagnosis of narcolepsy type 1 in particular. So for narcolepsy type 1, you need symptoms, and then we still do an overnight sleep study and a next day MSLT. However, if you have a sleep onset REM period on the overnight sleep study, meaning they go into REM within 15 minutes, that's abnormal. Normally, we enter REM sleep every about hour and a half or so of sleep. Then that counts as the two sleep onset REM periods that you may have on the next day sleep study. And abnormal mean sleep latency, according to the diagnostic criteria on a multiple sleep latency test, is less than 8 minutes. Another way that you can diagnose narcolepsy type 1 is to measure the CSF hypocretin. So that would include a lumbar puncture. There's the lab at Mayo is able to measure the CSF hypocretin levels. In my clinical practice, I have not done this, and I don't know if you've had a different experience, but I hear in Europe they do it a lot more.
Yeah, so it's a part of the standard practice very frequently that almost all patients in Europe do have it done. I do utilize this in my practice. I would say not all the time. It generally is in very unique circumstance. And the part that is evolving even with this is that what is diagnostic is less than 110 picograms per ml, but there's emerging literature that says that there is this borderland of 110 to 200 picograms per ml where you can still have narcolepsy type 1. I think what we have identified is that this less than 110 picograms per ml is a very, very specific group. I think everyone is going to agree if you have that measure that you are consistent with narcolepsy type 1. But I think we still are trying to figure out the biomarkers of these individuals beyond that. And so this is going to be an ongoing area, I think, of exploration. The Mayo Clinic is the only CLIA-certified lab that you can send this test to at this point in the United States.
And in narcolepsy type 2, just to add, you still need to do the overnight sleep study with the sleep diaries and have an overnight sleep study, at least 6 hours of sleep, and then the next day of the 5 naps have a mean sleep latency less than 8 minutes and 2 episodes of REM and those naps.
Perfect. And so this was something that I had alluded to earlier. It's how good of a job are we doing? Now, this survey at this point is a little bit older. It's from 2014. The AWAKEN survey, which stands for the Awareness and Knowledge of Narcolepsy, was something that had evaluated primary care physicians, general population, and sleep specialists. And this is something that I always find staggering. And again, if you're listening to this and you're a sleep doctor, I want you to really listen to these statistics and tell me, be honest with yourself, which category are you falling into? I'm hoping that you're at least one of these 22% and not one of the other more frequent. But tell me about what was the awareness and knowledge when asking, can you identify all five core symptoms? How well did the primary cares do and how well did the sleep docs do?
So this AWAKEN survey boggled my mind as well. It came out, as you mentioned, in 2014. And at that time, only 7% of PCPs and 22% of sleep specialists surveyed identified all five core symptoms of narcolepsy. So that's pretty poor. I wish we would repeat and do this survey again to see if awareness has increased, because I think there's been a lot of amazing awareness that's been promoted by a lot of the nonprofits and other groups, podcasts. So I think this will be changing, but this was a big call to action for sure.
Yeah, I would say that most recently, Wake Up Narcolepsy and Kira Maskey's group had done something modified in Boston, and unfortunately, the results were pretty disappointing as well. One of the things I want to call out is this is not saying that I'm trying to criticize people for not knowing the core symptoms. What I'm trying to highlight here is that the diagnostic journey for an individual with narcolepsy most typically is seeing 3 to 5 specialists before finally being diagnosed. And so when 7% of the primary carers are unable to recognize the core symptoms, those are our gatekeepers. So that means that we're referring to the wrong places. We're referring to infectious disease for Lyme and Epstein-Barr. We're referring to endocrine for thyroid. And when our sleep specialists are identifying it, it just means that everyone is being diagnosed with OSA or that we're telling people inappropriately that they have nothing wrong with them because we don't have the right diagnostic test. And so there are these validated measures to identify sleepiness. And the thing of it is that these are great screeners. Using things like the Epworth or the Epworth CHAD, which is the child and adolescent version, are great, and they can help you in being able to characterize, but please don't limit yourself as thinking that these are the end-all, be-all. And when we're talking about the Epworth, how would you kind of summarize the role of these and really what they're getting at?
So the Epworth Sleepiness Scale is a helpful, quick tool that the patients fill out on their own that just gives you an idea of how likely are they to fall asleep in certain typical situations? Are they watching TV or reading, riding in a car, sitting quietly after lunch without alcohol? And the ESS CHAD, the child and adolescent, has been modified. There's no alcohol. There's no driving. But they use this, and a lot of patients that come into the sleep clinic, we use it clinically, and over 10 is abnormal, and someone between 10 and 14 is more typical of someone with obstructive sleep apnea. But if you see numbers 16 and higher, 20, higher than that, you should have a high index of suspicion for hypersomnia disorder and narcolepsy.
And a big caution is just making sure that the person actually is answering this accurately. So this really is asking you about your propensity to doze. Many people interpret it as I fall asleep. Dozing and actually falling asleep are two different things. However, falling asleep is included in that. And in addition, if people don't kind of think about those symptoms and modify them. So very frequently people say, I would never fall asleep watching TV. And then the wife is like, yeah, that's because you stand up the whole time. Or I would never fall asleep in class, but that's because I pinch my leg to stay awake. So also kind of inquiring about some of the things that they use to modify.
Yeah, it's certainly not perfect and it has its limitations.
So this was awesome. In summary today, we have some specific goals that you can take away and to practice from this podcast. These are your SMART goals. They're specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. Use validated tools to help identify narcolepsy features such as excessive daytime sleepiness in patients who you suspect have a sleep disorder, particularly when your confidence to recognize these features may be lower. Consider evaluation of patients for narcolepsy if patients present with complaints of excessive daytime sleepiness, which may involve other symptoms that may seem unusual to you, as narcolepsy is frequently misdiagnosed and the diagnosis is all too commonly delayed. Thank you for this excellent discussion today, Lindsay. This has been completely awesome, and I think so telling of a lot of great information for people to put into action today. Two other podcast episodes on this series in which we more specifically discuss pharmacotherapy and treatment plans are also available.
Thank you so much, Anne, for having me.
All three narcolepsy podcast episodes and a wide variety of education and resources are available on the CME Outfitters Sleep Disorders Education Hub for both healthcare providers and patients.